Every week at Sunday service, some member of our Sangha reads an example, a sample from Master's wonderful book, Whispers from Eternity. The title itself, in a sense, tells the whole story. And Yogananda spoke of that book in two ways. One, he spoke of saying, when I am gone from this world and you wish to hear my voice, read my whispers from eternity, and through it I will speak to you. But Yogananda wrote that book while he was still in this world, and he actually titled it First, because that was how he received those prayers. He describes them as experiences that he had of God speaking to him. It was eternity whispering to him. And he writes in the introduction to that book, essentially, that the word eternity is a word he uses also to mean the infinite spirit, to mean divine mother, to mean heavenly father. All aspects of God can be encompassed with the simple word eternity, which means everlasting, unchanging. The word God is a very unspecific word in the English language, and we have to add to it other images in order for us to begin to grasp with our intuition and not just our reason what it is that we're talking about. And as it happened, Swami Kriyananda, the founder of Ananda, all of you know, is a direct disciple of Yogananda. And when he was a young monk with Yogananda in the last 3+ years of Yogananda's life, his guru told him, these are going to be your assignments for the rest of your life, because Kriyananda's now 60 years of discipleship were formed on 3.5 years of direct contact. So even though Kriyananda was 22 when he came and barely, just over 25 when his guru left this world, he wasn't always going to be a boy. He was going to be a great spiritual leader he has become. So his guru planted in him these expectations, and one of them was that he wanted him to edit Yogananda's words. And this has, of course, been a discussion that's gone on for all these decades since, which is one thinks in terms of a great master being perfect in all that he does, and so why would his writings have to be edited? In fact, there's a certain amount of how dare you edit the words of a great master. But Kriyananda has explained on many different occasions that the power of a master's awareness is first this intuitive vibration of direct revelation. And the effort to put such an experience into words, just by definition, it can never be put into words. By the time you've limited it to certain concepts that then are interpreted by the minds that receive them according to how those words associate with each one of us, you can see that the revelation itself no longer exists on that level. It can't, because that's a level beyond the mind. So Yogananda talks in his introduction to Whispers from Eternity how these words are spirit bombs. Bombs, not balm, but balm, exploding like that, and that they're limited by ink and paper, and that you tune into it and you have those spirit bombs explode in your own consciousness, and then the light is revealed. He's nothing if not exuberant and colorful in his images. But as Swamiji says, the sort of hard, slogging work of couching things just so in the right words so that they're all communicated is work that's always left to the disciples. In fact, most masters write nothing at all. Yogananda is unusual in how many written words he left. But even still, sometimes even now when you hear him speak, hear Yogananda's voice on tape, and often when I've heard Swami Kriyananda speak, one becomes aware that what's happening is this vibration of spirit is coming forth, and because it has to have some recognizable form for us in human bodies, I watched Swamiji speak once recently, and I just felt like this rush of spiritual energy was coming out, and as it passed through him, he pasted words on it. And then we got those words, and if we just clung to the words, we in a sense missed the message. I've discovered years ago I used to work some, taking some of Swami Kriyananda's written, spoken talks and converting them into articles, written articles. And it would always take a lot of tinkering, because when you're talking verbally, you can communicate so much. You listen to teenagers communicate, for example, and they'll say, well, you know, like, we were all there, and it was so, oh, yeah, I feel it. Oh, I know, too. Wow. And they've all actually understood each other. But if you transcribe that, you wouldn't really get a lot of content. But what happened was, vibrations went across. Now, of course, a master on a much higher level, Swami Kriyananda happens to be very intelligently articulate. My first experience, I think, of a truly elevated spiritual soul was when I was about 20 years old, and at that time I hadn't yet found Yogananda and Swami Kriyananda, and I often went to the Vedanta Society where disciples of Ramakrishna would speak, or disciples of Ramakrishna, a very great and beautiful line of teaching. And I went to the Hollywood Church because I lived in Southern California then, and this Indian Swami was there. It was the first time perhaps I'd ever even met an Indian or a Swami, and it was the first time definitely I'd met a saint. I can still remember this man. And I was very intellectual and content-oriented. And he stood up and started speaking, and I became aware of two things simultaneously. One, that the longer I sat there, the more expanded my consciousness became, and that the man wasn't making any sense. I mean, he was talking. It was just like one concept after another. It wasn't like he was incoherent. It's just that it was impossible to follow a thread of anything he was saying. And that was the first time it occurred to me, duh, that words weren't the end point of communication, that there was something completely other. And afterwards, we stood in a line and shook this man's hand, and still I can just see him. He just looked right through us. You could see that whatever he was perceiving, it was not what the rest of us were perceiving. And he shook our hands, and that feeling was so startling. Last week I was talking about how so many times this force, this divine force, tries to break through the rigidity of this world, and every so often we actually receive it. And when we do, what it does is it just begins to dismantle this sort of neat beginning and end kind of world that we live in and is the beginning of our true spiritual life. A friend and I were discussing the simple fact that you don't really learn spiritual teachings. You just have inner intuitions that you hear articulated. And when you hear them articulated or read them in a book or feel them in someone else's consciousness, you sort of say, yes, that's it. That's what real spirituality is. It's not studying dogmas and logicking them out. It's having this inner awareness, however inchoate it might be, and then gradually finding places where it resonates. And so Swamiji was working on this book that I was talking about, Whispers from Eternity. I was talking about him editing. And the book that we always read from is considered Master's original book. And Ananda was about to publish its own version of this original book. Swami had literally the typeset pages in his hand. It was about to go to the printer. And he felt this deep inner call from Master that says, this book needs editing. So he spent about 2 weeks just running through that whole book, and it'll be very interesting for all of us. What Larry was just reading was one of them specifically, I remember. I ended up getting sucked into the project because in 1974, when Swami wrote The Path, before there was a computer, I was his manuscript typist. He would write, and then he would edit by hand, and then I would retype the pages, and of course it was a glorious thing to do. So I ended up just this last summer, just a few weeks ago, back in that same role. Swamiji was receiving Master's inspiration in such a way that rather than sitting himself at a computer, he wrote it out with a pen. He sat with the palms in front of him, and as he said, he would read Master's words, and he would just hear in his mind Master's voice telling him how he would like the sentences changed. So he made many, many changes, not in the concept, but in the clarity of the expression. And then I would type them all in, and then he would read it again, and we would go back and forth for about 17 days. It was really miraculous how quickly he did it. Now, at the end of all of this, where I was really wanting to be with this, there's an essay at the beginning of Whispers that talks about how to pray. Because what Whispers really is, Master calls it a book of answered prayers, but what it really is, it's guidance on how to pray. Because our difficulty in our relationship with God, all of us, because we're the product of an ascending age, and most of the memories and the teaching we have of spirituality is influenced by this age of rigid materialism that we're just coming out of. And the whole concept of God that has been so popular in spiritual teaching and is followed in so many of the churches these days is based on the society that people lived in. I mean, think of the time of Jesus, too. This very rigid hierarchy, and there's always a king divinely appointed with all this power, and all the power is concentrated around that king, and the king is usually a little bit unpredictable in the way he relates. And in order to get to him, you have to sort of work your way into his presence, and then you have to beseech him, and you have to bow obsequiously, and you have to flatter all the people around him, and then you just have to hope that whatever you asked for will strike his fancy and be granted. And you never quite know whether it will or it won't. And the king has the same power to punish you or reward you. And so the whole concept of, well, if God is powerful, he must be the biggest king of all, don't you think? And if God lives in, if kings live in palaces, then God must live in the biggest palace that there is. And the whole, all the cathedrals of Europe that you go to, you know, were all an attempt to make God's palace even bigger than the most powerful monarch's palace. And you go to different churches and you see marked on the floor in St. Peter's, they have a line showing you this is how big the cathedral in Florence is, and then this is how much bigger St. Peter's Cathedral is. And so you get to see how the God who lives there has a bigger house than any of the other gods. One of my friends who grew up in a fairly dogmatic religion, when he was a rebellious little schoolboy, he was in Catholic school, and he didn't want to obey any of the rules. But the nuns tried to inspire him by telling him that if he did, he would have a bigger house in heaven, which, of course, was no incentive for him. So he became a very, very bad little boy because that was not what he wanted. But the end of all of that is that we tend to have this attitude when we pray that we have to flatter and hope for the best. And, of course, the truth of the matter is, as it has always been understood by great mystics and saints, is what we come into in our actual relationship with God is one of such sweet intimacy. It couldn't be any more different than the king and his obsequious servant. It just, you can't even imagine how different that is. Now, Jesus tried to advance the understanding by speaking of God the Father. If you ask your Father for a loaf of bread, will he give you a stone? Jesus was trying to break down this relationship of fear and trembling that people had with God. And it went a certain distance. Yogananda comes, he speaks of God as the mother, even more intimate. You can crawl on the mother's lap and she will always forgive you. But we have to go even a step beyond that. And so Yogananda calls his prayers prayer demands, that we don't have to ask. We have to say, Lord, this is what I need. This is how I understand it. But then in this book of answered prayers, he tells us how to have the right attitude in everything that we do. Because, of course, if you go to your mother, if she really loves you, or your father, if he really loves you, and absolutely demand something that they absolutely know is the worst possible thing for you, out of love, they're not going to give it to you. But if you're a child who truly trusts in the power of love, and mother and father are only representatives of the divine, if we truly trust in the power of love, we have no fear to ask. You see? Because this is our very own. The Lord loves us. He wants the very best for us. And this incredibly delicate balance between the humility to recognize that, gee, maybe what I think so strongly might not be true, and the fact that I must have the courage to say, but this is my reality and what shall we do with it? Many years ago, when I was a younger devotee, I got myself into a certain amount of trouble in my personal life. And Swami Kriyananda was in seclusion, even though I occasionally saw him, a few of us occasionally saw him, but he wasn't speaking, he was in silence, so when we would want to talk to him, we would either write notes or he would sit at his typewriter and he would type and we would talk. But I was in a lot of trouble, but I didn't want to bother him. But one of my friends told Swamiji that, you know, I was teetering on the edge of fairly stupid decisions and perhaps he might want to intervene. So he asked to see me. And we talked a little bit about this and that. And at the end of it, after we'd worked everything out, he said, why didn't you come to me with this? I said, well, I didn't want to disturb you. His response absolutely startled me. He said to me, "You insult my friendship." I thought I was being considerate. He said, "You insult my friendship." He said, "To even imagine that my convenience is more important than your welfare." He said, "What kind of a friend would I be to you if that were true?" Isn't that a marvelous thought? And think how often we relate to God in a way that's actually quite insulting. That we have to flatter, we have to beg, we have to be this, we have to be so afraid, we can't really reveal, we have to put on all this front. We insult his friendship. We insult his unconditional love. We insult his generosity. We insult his wisdom, or her wisdom, however you want to think about it. This is what Master reveals in all of these poems that you can read in this book, and in a matter of a couple of weeks you'll be able to see Swamiji's clarified version of it. Just poem after poem after poem in which we are in this dynamic, intimate, fearless relationship of, here we are, Lord, we're in it together, let's see what happens next. You know, this is what Jesus is talking about. I am the vine, it's true, but you are the branches. You know, where does one begin? Where does the other end? Where does the branches say, "Oh, I don't want to bother the vine"? Or how can the branches say, "Oh, the fruit that I bear is only mine"? You see, what a complete difference. And where is the obstacle to this? It's not in the spirit. It's in the human heart, isn't it? It's into that simple realization that the divine light which encircles the infinite ones is also my own. That's why we have that line in the Bible, "As many as received him, to them gave he the power to become the sons of God." And when Swami Kriyananda wrote the Festival of Light, he picked a line here and a line there from the Bible, from the Gita, just a few, just a, you know, a handful of words that we repeat every week. And one of them is, "As many as received him." Because every week when we repeat that, we need to say to ourselves, "Am I receiving him? If I feel distant, if I feel that my prayers are falling on deaf ears, who is to blame? Am I receiving him? Do I believe? Can I come to believe that all the power of the infinite is also mine?"